seated. Good afternoon. We're going to hear our third case of the day. 09-AP-1212-10-AP-491, Estate of Brianna Creekwall versus Sizzler USA Franchise, Inc. And we have a long array of lawyers and time, so I'll read it out and see if this is what you all agree with. We first hear from Ms. Carstensen, who is appearing pro hoc vici, will be introduced by attorney Nora Gierke. 15 minutes. 15 minutes for Terry Johnson. Mr. Johnson, if we didn't ask if you wanted to appear on two cases on the same day, I apologize because we asked. That's what I figured, but nevertheless, so. 15 minutes for Frederick Gordon, who appears pro hoc vici, who will be introduced by attorney Noah Fiedler. 5 minutes, Paula Carstensen for rebuttal. 5 minutes for Terry Johnson for rebuttal. 5 minutes for Frederick Gordon in rebuttal. Is that right? Okay, good. I'm going to ask, we have 5 issues in the case at last count. And I'll ask counsel to tell the court, if you would, what issue you're addressing. And the court will try and remember that and not ask you about other issues, but of course the court can ask any questions it wishes. And if all the issues aren't covered because you've decided to rest on your briefs, the court might ask you questions on what's on your brief, but it would help all of us stay focused. All right. We'll first hear from attorney Nora. Is it Gierke?
Good afternoon, Justices. Nora Gierke, appearing on behalf of Gierke Frank, LLC. And here with me is my colleague. I'd like to introduce Paula Carstensen of Bays Carey, and she will be handling the argument. Thank you.
Lawyer of good standing in Illinois.
Yes, she is.
Okay. Thank you. Your motion on pro hoc vici is granted.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Carstensen, welcome to Wisconsin. We have many Chicago people who come here for R&R.
And my son attended the university here, so I love Madison. But thank you, Your Honor.
It's a good way to start.
If it please the court, my name is Paula Carstensen. I represent Excel Corporation and American Home Insurance. I was planning to first argue the consequential damage issue and then move to the Perringer issue in the 15 minutes. I'll, of course, entertain any questions you have on other issues. Mm-hmm. In this case, as you know, stems from this third-party litigation arising out of an E. coli outbreak at two restaurants in July 2000. This case presents a significant issue for Wisconsin in that while the courts below correctly found that consequential damage limitation contained in the contract between Sizzler and Excel barred Sizzler's claim for lost profits under a theory of express warranty, they erroneously concluded that it did not bar the identical claim for lost profits under an implied warranty theory. If allowed to stand, the ruling would render a damage limitations agreed upon by two sophisticated parties, which the trial court had bargained for this agreement at arm's length. It renders the agreement useless. Excel unambiguously disclaimed all liability for consequential damages resulting from the breach of the sales contract by stating, "This guarantee shall not render seller liable for any consequence, incidental or consequential damages of whatsoever nature." I expect that Sizzler will argue today, as it has before the other courts and as the Court of Appeals found, that somehow this language, this guarantee, restricts the consequential damage exclusion to express warranties created by the guarantee. and does not extend implied warranties. However, that interpretation really renders the whole provision useless and irrelevant. And as you know, in construing contracts, you have to give meaning and effect to all the provisions. The fact that the damage limitation applies to all warranties arising out of the contract is shown by the party's course of conduct and dealings in negotiating this contract. SISLA required that this guarantee be given to it as a continuing term of its annual sales agreement, and it demanded the provision because it had purportedly had prior problems with Excel's meat back in like 5 years ago. So in accepting this as part of their contract, they could have asked to strike that clause, or they could have chosen not to do business with us, but they elected to accept it.
Explain to me why that language, this guarantee, renders the rest of that provision useless. I don't understand that.
Well, our argument is that the both express and implied warranties, the genesis of those warranties arise out of the sales agreement as a whole, and this is an integrated provision in the sales agreement. So you cannot parse out, SISLA can't embrace the guarantee and say, you breached the guarantee, but I'm not going to accept the damage limitation in the agreement. And granted, I haven't found any Wisconsin cases that address this particular issue right on point, but we've cited many out-of-state cases which also hold that under the Uniform Commercial Code, there's no necessity for a disclaimer of consequential damages to be conspicuous or contain magic language referencing applied warranties.
Counsel, wouldn't it have been relatively easy in setting forth this particular guarantee to cover implied warranties? Especially dealing with food products, it's not unusual to look at whether or not there are implied warranties of merchantability or implied warranties of fitness. So what would have been the difficulty in doing that?
I don't think there would have been a difficulty in including that, but I don't think it was necessary to do so because of the broad nature of the statement that it extends to any consequential damages whatsoever. And you have to look at the context in which this was negotiated. You know, SISLA was, I know they're going to come up and argue, we were duped, you gave us bad meat. They entered into this at a time when they fully knew that was a possibility. So I think you have to look at the circumstances as a whole and apply it and apply it to both warranties. I kind of look at it as you have your implied warranties are a remedy. We are not limiting the remedy they could recover. They could recover the new meat. They could recover the purchase price of the meat. We are carving out consequential damages limitations. And if they can come in and say, well, that's not barred simply because there does exist an implied warranty, that's our argument pertaining to how that particular agreement would render.
Well, wasn't this agreement the result of your client wanting to get back the SISLA USA business?
It was, but it was also done in the context of knowing, you know, the potential consequential damages that were out there. And there are many products that producers won't even produce because those potentials are there. So then the parties are free to allocate their risks in their contract as they see fit. And I really believe that this is what happened here. The courts, though, have consistently said we're not going to apply it because the Uniform Commercial Code requires you to disclaim warranties as well as limit damages. And I have not found a single case that says that. And I guess I would refer the court, I think the most analogous case I cite in our brief, although we cite four out-of-state cases is the Covistar case. And in that, in the guarantee, it states, Cooley limits this warranty, Cooley is the seller, to the above-mentioned conditions and will not be liable for subsequent or consequential damages. That makes no reference to implied warranties, but the court found that that is a valid consequential damage limitation that extends beyond the guarantee to implied warranties.
Well, I gather that this is an interpretation of the contract, right? The contract says, this is on a continuing guarantee, the contract gives a guarantee, right, is hereby guaranteed as of the date of each such shipment to be not adulterated or misbranded, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it says this guarantee shall not render a seller liable for incidental or consequential damages. The court interprets, the Court of Appeals, as I understand it, interprets the word this guarantee in the contract to mean only the express guarantee, right?
Right.
Parties from one case to another can differ as to the intent of the contract, what it means, right?
You can differ as to the intent, yes. And then,
even using the same words, parties may not be using them the same way, or in the context of the case, they're not the same. So do you think that this is this a question of law for the court?
I do think it's a question of the law for the court to determine if the language is unambiguous or ambiguous. But in the context here, I believe it is unambiguous because you can look to this guarantee, and it is part of the sales agreement. When they argued this case to the jury, they put it up on the big screen. They said, here's our guarantee. It applies to each and every product that we sell. So then why wouldn't the damage limit apply under those circumstances? I think it's a very hyper-technical reading to say that it doesn't address implied warranties because they all arise out of the same agreement.
You could have an implied warranty even if you didn't have an express warranty.
Yes, you could.
What part of this continuing guarantee can you point to that would lead me to conclude that it is something in addition to an express guarantee?
Well, it's an express, it's a damage limitation.
Provision. Well, I'm talking about the guarantee. I mean,
it is an express guarantee.
It's an express guarantee.
And the agreement of the parties also, as every sales agreement has an implied guarantee or implied warranty for fitness of a particular purpose or various implied warranties. But inherent in that argument and in the exclusion is the fact that they arise out of the same agreement. You can't have an express warranty and no sales contract.
Well, I think the focus is on, in part, the word this. I assume this refers to this continuing guarantee.
Yes, this continuing guarantee, which is an integrated term of the sales contract. And if you look at the Covistar opinion, they rejected that argument that you, just because it appears in the portion of the contract addressing guarantee, it doesn't extend beyond the four corners of all the implied warranties encompassed by that agreement. I would move on then and address the Peringer release in the brief time that I have left.
Could I ask?
Sure.
If I understand this, you have three members of the court who are either present or former members of the Uniform State Laws Conference. And we're all very interested in uniformity. Do you have cases that show that express warranties of this nature with their exceptions or caveats can overcome?
Can encompass, but yes. We
uniform
cited,
laws?
We cited in our brief the Covistar case, the Benowit case, and Wyatt Industries versus Publicker and the Oroch's case. And I guess I would point to the Oroch's holding. In that case, the agreement stated, we shall have no liability for consequential damages, whether based on tort or contract. The court found that although, and it was citing Wyatt when it issued this ruling, that although that statement doesn't reference implied warranties, the limitation was a damage limitation. It's not modifying the warranty, so it doesn't have to have this this reference to implied warranties. And I think that, you know, otherwise, if you're going to only hold it to an express warranty in the context of any sales agreement, then it's not going to have any meaning or effect, and that is that would contradict regular contract interpretation rule.
UCC doesn't cover the interpretation of limiting consequential damages, does it?
The contract interpretation, the UCC says you can limit them. They are not to be unconscionable in the context of a commercial agreement like this where everyone is aware that they're not unconscionable. And it doesn't provide any requirement, and I found no case stating, I think we do cite a case in our brief that says you don't have to have magic language in terms of putting forth that limitation.
And none of the provisions that you just set forth in the UCC is involved in this case. This is a contract clause interpretation.
Well, I think it is involved in the case to the extent that the Court of Appeals, they kind of went beyond saying this is a mere contract interpretation. You're going to hear otherwise from Mr. Gordon, but they went on to say you can't have a valid consequential damage limitation unless you somehow modify or limit or reference implied warranties. And I would say that is absolutely not true, and so that's why this case presents a bad precedent in this matter where the parties agreed to this limitation provision.
Behringer.
Okay. So we would ask for judgment on that claim. Am I out of time now? Or
no. The orange light indicated 5 minutes, and you probably used several of those. So.
Yeah. I would turn, and I can address this just briefly, to the Behringer release issue. This is, again, an issue that I've not found a Wisconsin case on point in this particular issue. But E&B were seeking indemnity under what I would interpret as a contribution-type indemnity agreement. I don't think they dispute that that agreement does not apply to provide them an indemnity for their own causal negligence. In short, because I see the red light is on, they settled with a Behringer release, which is an admission that they're settling their own causal negligence. So I don't believe under the circumstances of this case they should have been entitled to indemnity on that claim.
Counselor, the Behringer release comes out of tort law, and their claim is actually for contribution, right, because it's a portion based on the underlying negligence. And so they're asking for contribution from a joint tortfeasor,
right,
but they're asking for it in the context of a contract, right?
They are asking for
it. So it's kind of a different intersection, which is probably why you haven't found it in Wisconsin law, because it's a tort concept that you are wanting us to apply in a contract claim, right?
That's correct. But I don't think it makes a difference because of the nature of those releases.
Well, why don't you expound on that a little bit further? That's a little short for me to...
Oh, in terms...
You may do so, counsel.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. The Behringer release itself, it's meant to establish finality and to provide that E&B settled its own causal negligence. Had we had a contractual indemnity situation where they were trying to get indemnity for their own as well as Excel's negligence, we might have a different situation here. And my argument is that because it affords no greater right than the right of contribution under the common law, I don't see why the principles of Behringer shouldn't apply to this case.
So what you're saying is that the contract itself, in
incorporates the principles of Perringer? Is that what you're saying?
No, it incorporates the principles, and I don't think A&B disputes this, of contribution among joint tortfeasors. It's not a it's not an indemnification where they get indemnity for their own negligence or fault.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would request that we be given the relief requested in our brief.
Thank you, Ms. Carstensen, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Terry Johnson, representing A&B Management Company and Secura Insurance.
May it please the Court, my name is Terry Johnson, and I have the privilege of appearing before you to represent two parties, the defendant, respondent, cross-appellant, cross-petitioner, A&B Management Company of Waukesha, and its principal insurer, the defendant, respondent, cross-appellant, Secura Insurance. And for sake of using my time wisely, from now on I'm going to refer to them as Secura and A&B. I'm going to be addressing two issues, one briefly and one at a little greater length. The first issue is what we perceive to have been the error by the Court of Appeals in ordering that the judgment below be amended by deleting our recovery for the $800,000 that the court determined A&B was entitled to recover based upon the contribution made on its behalf by one of its insurers, Federal Insurance Company, toward the settlements that were made in the underlying cases. And the second is the issue which was briefly addressed by counsel for Excel just a moment ago, and that is the Perringer issue. I'd like to take up the first issue briefly first, because I think, in all honesty, it is obvious when one reads the Fisher decision by Chief Justice Abramson that the Court of Appeals misconstrued that decision and misapplied it to this case. The Fisher case says quite clearly that in considering three doctrines, only two of which are applicable here, the rules of subrogation and the rules of collateral source, that there are three cases that are instructive, discussed at length in Fisher, synthesized in Fisher, but all consistent: Paulson, Vogie, and Fisher. And as Fisher tells us, the basic rule is this: a party is entitled to recover funds paid by someone on its behalf, an insurer on its behalf, which arguably had subrogation rights, only if that insurer expressly waives those rights. If the insurer takes action to try to collect on those rights, whether it settles, as in, I think, Paulson and Vogie, or in Fisher, where it actually litigated those rights, and in one of the things I always tell clients about, and that is they lost 100-0 in the arbitration proceeding, and then they won 100-0 in the civil trial, which shows us the dangers that litigation presents for us. But in that case, in the cases where the insurer asserted its rights and either settled those rights or litigated them and either won or lost, the insured can't recover that because their rights of subrogation trump the insured's rights to benefit from the collateral source rule. On the other hand, in those cases where, as the court pointed out, in Vogie, with regard to the UIM portion of the case, the insurer didn't pursue its rights, didn't raise its subrogation rights, in effect became someone who didn't have subrogation rights by voluntarily giving them up, then the insured gets the benefit of it, because then the collateral source rule that a tortfeasor doesn't benefit from the fact that the person it injures has other sources of compensation available to it trumps the rule about subrogation. That could not be more clear. That's exactly what you said in a decision that, as Judge Riley pointed out in the oral argument before the Court of Appeals, had come out that day that I hadn't read. I read the sports page that morning, but not the appellate decisions. What?
Nothing. I just said, how could you?
As I told somebody a moment ago, even if I read appellate decisions first thing in the morning, I wouldn't admit it. But the fact of the matter is, in that case, you said that if an insurer pays money and then waives its right of subrogation, the insured gets the benefit of what they would like to call a windfall, rather than them getting the benefit of what we would call a windfall for them. That's exactly what happened here.
Mr. Johnson, let me interrupt you for a minute.
Sure.
Don't you have a problem with the collateral source rule in that your client is a tortfeasor here?
We're a tortfeasor. We are a tortfeasor vis-a-vis the injured parties. We're not a tortfeasor versus them. We're a party injured by them by their breach of contract. And we're suing for the damages we sustained as a result of their breach of contract. We're an injured party.
See, I don't read it that way. The case law seems to me to make it clear that the collateral source rule is not intended and was never intended to benefit a tortfeasor. And any way you cut it, your client was found by the jury to be responsible to the tune of 20%.
That would mean then that if, for example, there was a multiple car accident and the person who's making the claim had also been sued by somebody and recovered, they would be barred from getting the benefit of the collateral source rule with regard to their claims against others. I don't see that as either good public policy or dictated by the law of the state. The fact of the matter is...
That's what the Court of Appeals said, did it not?
I'm sorry?
That is what the Court of Appeals said.
Correct. But that's because the Court of Appeals, I think, missed the fact that whereas we were a tortfeasor vis-a-vis those injured parties, the ones we settled with, that's the Perringer I'll come to, with regard to them, we are suing as a party injured by them. This case is no different than if they made us sick. They came to us. They caused us millions of dollars of damages. They destroyed our business. They exposed us to huge liability to third parties. And everyone knows now, because 8 years after the fact, they finally admitted it, that the reason E. coli was in these restaurants is because they gave it to us. They sold it to us in violation of their agreement. The evidence is clear. They did it because they weren't particularly careful about complying with their guarantees, just like they weren't particularly careful in complying with their indemnity agreements either.
Counselor, aren't you kind of doing the same thing that I talked to counsel for XL about? You're trying to take a tort doctrine and insert it in a contract claim, right? The collateral source rule has nothing to do with contract law.
Actually, I don't think I'm the one who's doing that. I think they are.
You think they are? Just let me finish. Then the collateral source rule should have nothing to do with whether you get indemnification. But I thought you brought it up by saying Federated made this claim. They've waived their subrogation rights. Therefore, I'm an injured party, so I should be able to pick that up. To me, that sounds like collateral source. So maybe I just interpreted what you said wrong.
I am responding to their argument. Their argument has always been we can't recover that money because we didn't pay it, and the basis for it is that we don't qualify under the collateral source rule. The collateral source rule doesn't apply, then these were monies that were paid to settle these claims, and it doesn't matter where they came from.
Okay, just look at your contract claim under your contract with them for the Hold Harmless contract.
I'll explain it exactly as I would.
Just looking at that, forget about there was an underlying action. Tell me why you should prevail.
If they had performed on their contract, since we all know they eventually admitted they caused the E. coli to be in the restaurants, when we tendered the defense of all these claims to them in 2000, they would have defended, indemnified, and held us harmless. They would have defended us. They would have paid the expenses. They would have settled all these cases. They didn't settle these cases. They didn't defend us. They didn't do anything. They ran up our defense costs by instead claiming things that turned out not to be true. As a result, we were put to enormous expense. They harmed us by their breach of contract. One of the ways we incurred that expense was by paying out $3.5 million to settle over 130 claims from people. We're entitled to recover that from them because they caused that harm to my client.
Okay,
they say that because a portion of that was paid by federal insurance, they don't have to pay it.
Okay. Are they saying they don't have to pay anything or just the $1 million? I thought we were just talking about the $1
million. Well, they have two arguments. The first one, the one I'm talking about now, is the $800,000, the million discounted by 20%.
Right.
But they're saying that even if the Perringer doesn't bar it, we don't get the $800,000 because federal paid it. And they're the ones who are introducing the issue of does it matter where the money came from? And what I'm saying, as an injured party, it doesn't matter because that insurer waived its rights to collect because they harmed us by their breach of contract.
Okay, so if you don't look at Perringer and you don't look at the collateral source rule and you just look at the contract that you have with XL, you think under that contract, forgetting everything else, you ought to prevail.
Yes. And on the Perringer rule, which is the next question, you need to put this in context. There is no Wisconsin case directly on point here. There are two cases that have been talked about in the pleadings. One's closer in the briefs. One's closer than the other. The close one is Edenstone. And Edenstone is close because it talks about whether the fact that you had entered into a Perringer to settle a contract claim affects your right to get indemnity later. And the Court of Appeals said, no, it doesn't. You can get your indemnity. In this case, we settled contract claims. We settled breach of warranty claims by all of these people who were in the restaurant who had breach of implied warranty claims against us because we sold them food and they got sick. So we did settle contract claims. What makes it slightly different than Edenstone is we also settled tort claims because they also, by and large, either directly, expressly, or impliedly, were claiming we were negligent and violated our duties under product liability law. Where they're wrong about it is when they try to argue that Unigard is on point. Unigard isn't on point both because it only involved tort claims, number one, and second of all, because there wasn't any indemnity, there wasn't any indemnification case there. I realize the pleading said it, but there is no legal theory under which that party could possibly have gotten indemnification. They had a contribution claim. A person who supplied a product that caused the injury was suing installers, not in the product chain, claiming they were negligent in the way they installed it. That's a tort claim for contribution. It's not an indemnity case, but it's not this case either. So the question then becomes, under the facts of this case, what should the law be? Here's the facts of this case. They agreed in 1993 they would not sell us adulterated meat. They agreed that if they would, and they had to agree it to sell it because of the problems they already had. They then agreed that if they ever did sell us adulterated meat, they would protect, indemnify, and hold us harmless, even if there was just an allegation that the meat was defective. They then, the record shows, didn't do much of a job to stop selling us contaminated meat. As a matter of fact, their claim at trial was the reason the meat was contaminated, everybody knows the meat's contaminated. It's all contaminated. It's frequently contaminated. Despite their agreement, you should have been more careful because you knew we were selling you contaminated meat. Then, when the problem started and all these people got sick and presented their claims, they walked away from it. They refused to defend. They refused to indemnify. They refused to hold us harmless. They forced us into settling all these cases. We worked very, very hard, our clients and our firm, to settle these cases. We did right by these people. We paid out $3.5 million, and we didn't put them through the litigation mill, all on our own, and we kept asking them and asking them and asking them, please participate, please pay, please pay some attention to your promises. Instead, they lied for years and said it wasn't their fault until they admitted it on the eve of trial. And now, because they did that, and because they forced us into agreements where the record reflects the initial plaintiffs asked for Perringer releases, you know what they say? Because of what we did, because of the position we put you in, we're excused entirely from performing on our contract. I'm sorry. That is ridiculous. The law should not reward them for breaching their contract, which is exactly what they're asking you to do.
Did I hear you say earlier that you settled about 130 claims?
Yes, we settled every claim except the one wrongful death claim, which was eventually settled and is not directly involved in this case. Over 130 claims. I think about 10 were in suit and another 120 or 125 that were not in suit.
How many Perringers were utilized?
The record is not particularly clear on that. The record is clear. We began to use Perringers, and I think the record reflects typically Perringers were used after that. There's not a record as to each and every one. The Court of Appeals, I think, has resolved that issue against us, and I'm not here to debate it. But the record's not particularly good in that regard. But here's the situation. We didn't just settle our negligence claim. We settled our product liability claims. Our product liability claims were for 100% of the damages, both under strict liability, because we're in the product chain, we're going to pay for everything, their share and our share, and we did. They never got sued by any of these people. They never had to pay any of those claims because we paid them for them. In addition, under warranty, we're liable for the fact that we sold their contaminated deadly meat. We paid for their share. The fact that the plaintiff theoretically was only giving up the 20% that was attributed to us is a distortion of the facts of this case. The fact of this case is those plaintiffs all were paid entirely by us. They've admitted they introduced the meat, and the jury apportioned 80% of the fault to them. And they say that because they breached their contracts and put us in the position where we had to settle their liability under product liability law, their liability under implied warranty, they don't have to pay anything. As soon as you say that, it's not right. And there's nothing in Wisconsin law that says that's the result. In Perringer, you decided, this court decided, in a situation where there wasn't a way of solving this problem of comparative negligence and settling with one defendant, that you would find a way to encourage settlements so that people could settle that way buy their peace against the other defendants, and protect themselves. You can do that today. You can say today, in this situation, it is the public policy of the state of Wisconsin to give people freedom to settle cases. It is the public policy of the state of Wisconsin to give people the negotiating freedom to do what they need to do to compensate people.
What's the difference in the dollar amount that is talked about in the claim that has the Perringer issue and the claim that has the collateral source rule issue? What's the difference in the dollar amount?
Rounding it slightly, the total amount that was paid was approximately $3.5 million.
So it's the same dollars you're talking about in both parts? In both arguments?
Not quite, if I could finish.
Okay.
The overall Perringer issue is $3.5 million. $2.5 million was paid by Secura, just a fraction underneath that. And $1 million was paid by Federal. Okay. So under the Court of Appeals decision, we would be entitled to recover 80% of the roughly $2.5 million. Under the trial court's decision, we were entitled to recover that and the 80% of the $1 million because of the court said we were entitled to recover on Federal's contribution as well. E&B was entitled to recover.
So it's the same package of payment, but part of it, the $2.5 million is stuck under the Perringer argument, and the $1 million is stuck under the what I call the collateral source concern.
Under the Perringer argument, because the total of $3.5 million was paid under the Perringer, they just have a second argument on the million because
okay.
of where it came from.
Gotcha, gotcha. Okay.
Secura has
much.
The claim for the $2.5 million reduced okay. by 20%. E&B, we say, has the claim for 80% of the $1 million.
Okay. Good,
so
great.
What we're asking you to do in this appeal is to reverse that portion of the Court of Appeals decision, which took away the $800,000 based upon its interpretation of our rights to the federal $1 million payment, and reinstate exactly the judgment that was awarded by the trial court.
You, when you are wearing your E&B hat, you want, when you're, I know this is a bad room for hearing both ways. When you're wearing your E&B hat, you want us to say, you can collect $800,000 out of the $1 million that Federated pays because they're not trying to get collection. And when you're wearing your Secura hat, you're telling us you should get paid the $2.5 million based on your contract.
I guess I would say it's differently. Both my clients are saying the same thing. There's no disagreement between them on this.
Well, I'm just talking about where the money
right.
goes.
Under the judgment, Secura got, among other things, a judgment for 80% of roughly $2.5 million.
Okay.
E&B got
okay.
a judgment for 80% of the million.
Okay. E&B They're both lost, at 80%.
Right.
Okay.
E&B lost right. its 80% of the million under the Court of Appeals decision. Okay. That's what we're asking you to reinstate.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Thank you.
My light is on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Frederick Gordon, you're going to be introduced by Attorney Noah Fiedler. Mr. Fiedler.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Noah Fiedler. I'm one of the attorneys that represent Sizzler. It's my privilege to introduce to you my friend and co-counsel, Fred Gordon of Gordon & Holmes. He is an attorney in good standing in California.
Thank you, Mr. Fiedler. Your motion will be granted. Welcome to our state, Mr. Gordon. I think it's kind of Wisconsin to give you a relief of San Diego weather.
Thank you. May it please the court. I am Frederick Gordon of Gordon & Holmes, and we've had the opportunity and privilege of representing Sizzler in this action for 12 years. I've been here many times, and I'm very fond of...
Are you paying taxes as a resident?
I'm not, but I almost could be. But I wanted to start out by telling you that it's a privilege for me and an honor to argue in this magnificent courtroom. It is, I've been all around the country, and I have never been in a courtroom as magnificent as this building.
I agree with you. I think it's so beautiful.
And I've also been a trial lawyer for 30 years, and I've never had an opportunity to come before decision makers and ask them to merely follow the decisions that they've already rendered in the past. They were those decisions which were clear, fair, reasonable, and, by the way, support Sizzler's position on each and every issue that we're dealing with in this in these appeals. I'm dealing with three issues: the remedies limitation clause, the equitable indemnity rights to recover under our advance payment, and also the equitable indemnity rights to recover the approximately $1.75 million in attorney's fees pursuant to the Weinhagen rule, which provides for a measure of consequential damages to an innocent party who has been subjected to litigation through no fault of their own. I want to address a question that Justice Crooks threw out, is how easy it would have been if XL truly believed that their language extended to all remedies under both express and implied warranties to say so. And in fact, this court, in a variety of decisions, including the Murray decision and including the Phillips Petroleum decision and including and the Court of Appeal in the Trinkle decision, all of which were cited to you, all analyze what words can be used if someone wants to try to limit either warranties or remedies, both express and implied. This guarantee is a restrictive word. This relates to a guarantee. It would have been very easy, and in fact, had XL followed the language of even any of the out-of-state jurisdictions that they claim support their position, which they don't, because the Court of Appeal correctly analyzed that all of those provisions were expansively written, saying under no circumstances can the seller be obligated to pay consequential damages. Under no circumstances. Well, you don't need the magic words, and that's what the code says, and that's what the Court of Appeal did. It first analyzed this question as a straight breach of contract, and then said, I'll give XL the benefit of the doubt. Let me see if there's anything in the code, under the Uniform Commercial Code, which will help them out, and Judge Fine correctly analyzed that there was nothing in the code that caused this remedies limitation to extend past the express warranty. The reason XL asks you to expansively analyze it is because what they want to do is leave Sizzler without any adequate remedy at all. And we know from Phillips Petroleum, and we know from the Trinkle case, that when you have a unconscionable, when you have a remedies limitation of an implied warranty of merchantability or fitness, the mere fact that you limit it is not the end of the analysis, because then you must take the additional step and determine whether or not there was an adequate minimum remedy provided even within the context of the restriction. Otherwise, it's unconscionable. And that's exactly the situation that this court ruled could not stand with Phillips Petroleum. And in this case, the facts are so far egregious from petroleum that they should never be able to wipe out all of the remedies under this code, because the code itself says, and the comments to the code say, that under no circumstances can you have less than an adequate minimum remedy. Now I'm going to move on to the next issue, and that deals with the voluntary payment of $1.5 million that Sizzler was compelled to make. And the argument down below in the circuit court, which was reversed by the Court of Appeal, was that somehow Sizzler was a volunteer. That was the sole attack on the propriety of the granting Sizzler recovery under the theory of equitable indemnity. But we know, and we know it from the decision in Creefall 1, where the Court of Appeal specifically said, it doesn't matter if you mishandle beef or undercook it or abuse it in any way. It doesn't kill people if it's not poisoned in the first place. And that's XL's responsibility. And that's something that they affirmatively denied. And we've put in the record the part of an argument that I made, it was, and they never stipulated till it was theirs, that it was theirs, until right before trial, because their theory was that a cockroach did it. They had an expert who they agreed to withdraw, Dr. Gangarosa, who was actually going to sit on a witness stand and say that a cockroach contaminated food in one store and got in a car, and I'm not kidding you, got in a car and drove over to the other location and contaminated that location as well. And so that's why we said under equitable indemnity, the court has a lot of other facts that aren't in front of a jury, because those facts weren't put forth in front of the jury, to consider when determining whether or not it's appropriate to grant equitable indemnity. And in this case, and in this court's prior rulings, the cases that we cited, Rush, Farmers Mutual, Perkins, and quite frankly, I was preparing last night and I found another case that's not in our brief, but it's a decision by the Chief Justice of Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. All of them say you cannot be deemed a volunteer if you are being sued and subject to potential liability.
Counsel, what's the standard of review here? The trial court found that this was a voluntary payment. Was that a finding of fact that we will uphold unless it's clearly erroneous?
I believe, Your Honor, that the standard of review here is de novo, because when there are undisputed facts and a violation of the law, it is a de novo review. And the undisputed facts were that Sizzler was being sued and it paid an advance payment. Those facts are undisputed. However, even if you were reviewing this under an abusive process, in light of this court's prior rulings, there is no way that this court can accept that someone who is being sued, allegedly for their own bad conduct, who makes a payment, can ever be deemed a volunteer, and it doesn't make sense otherwise.
So you're saying that the statement by the trial court that this was a voluntary payment is really a statement of law and not a finding of fact?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that under either standard, that court was wrong. But I'm saying the standard I believe applies here is that you are analyzing undisputed facts and the law. So I believe that even if I came to you and said this is abusive process standard, I would still ask you to uphold the Court of Appeals ruling. Because the Court of Appeal rightly analyzed, and the Court of Appeal obviously is an error-correcting court, the Court of Appeal properly analyzed that there was a distinction between the two payments that Sizzler made. The one payment was for funeral expenses. And then, and the record correctly shows, I then was examining Mr. Bopel, the witness, and then he said, after that, then we made another payment, and that was pursuant to the advance payment statute. Two completely separate issues that should not be conjoined. I agree the first one, you know what, I don't even agree the first one was a voluntary payment because we were being sued at the time. So, but once you're being sued, it's not possible, and if the court made a factual finding, it was wrong and it's an abuse of
The first one was an anonymous payment. Was the first one an anonymous payment?
It was an anonymous payment.
Sounds a little bit voluntary to me.
Well,
you can dispute it.
It was only because, as Mr. Bopel testified, he didn't want someone to look poorly upon Sizzler, suggesting that Sizzler was trying to do some type of end around or something like that. And so he preferred it to that payment in and of itself to be anonymous. But the 1.5 wasn't, and it was clearly down the road. It was in 2005 that it was made, which obviously promotes the policy behind that statute, is to provide victims with funds during the pendency of the litigation, as opposed to taking the position that a cockroach caused this outbreak.
Mr. Gordon, when the $1.5 million was paid, it's my understanding that it was paid pursuant to a written document that specifically referred to the Chapter 885 provision in regard to advance payment. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct.
Does that help you or hurt you?
I don't think it is of no moment. I mean, it's memorialized, but quite frankly, Your Honor, what the cases say, what this court's prior cases say is, you can make it. It doesn't really matter what language you use, as long as the payment is being made as a result of you being a target.
And at that point, there was a lawsuit pending?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. The lawsuit was filed in July of 2000. The payment was made in August of 2005. And so finally, I want to go to the last issue of attorney's fees. And this is another interesting thing because, for the most part, obviously, I agree with the rationale of the Court of Appeal. But in this particular case, I just found it interesting that there was no real analysis or cases that the Court of Appeal used in citing for its decision. And when I look back, and we outline this extensively in our response brief, when I look back at the purpose of the Weinhagen rule, it's to say that those who are placed in litigation as a result of someone else's either breach of contract or tortious conduct, and but for that those actions, one would not be in litigation. In that narrow instance, then as a consequential damage, that innocent third party should be entitled to seek recovery from the bad person who put him there in the first place. That's the exact situation we have here, as I previously said, as was outlined in the Creefall 1 decision, acknowledging that this outbreak does not occur without not only the contractual breaches, but the tortious conduct that the jury found. I mean, when I was reading the Excel response, I was thinking, well, are they trying to retry the case in response? Because I would have almost thought that Sizzler wasn't found 0% responsible. But Sizzler was found 0% responsible. And Sizzler was required to expend about $1.75 million in defense costs that it should never have incurred because Excel breached its contract. And there's a sound public policy about doing that, because why should someone who breaches a contract, or why is someone who commits a tort and embroils an innocent party in litigation, why do they get a windfall? As opposed to what this court has previously said in Phillips Petroleum, is what we want to do is make innocent victims whole. And if you don't reverse the appellate court, you will not make Sizzler, who was an innocent victim, 0% responsible for this outbreak, you will not make it whole. And it should be made whole.
Mr. Gordon, let me interrupt you in that regard, too. Weinhagen is an old case, 1922, from
yes.
what I remember. And there's a later case that's discussed by the Court of Appeals, Community Care Organization of Milwaukee County. And it's my understanding that their approach in that case comes from an interpretation of Weinhagen. And they talk about the fact that this is a state that follows the American rule. And the American rule, as you know, means you pay your own attorney's fees. But they go on to say, unless authorized by statute or by a contract between the parties. Now, isn't that what you're missing here in regard to your claim?
Not at all, Your Honor, because if number one, that's an appellate court case, and that is not consistent with the fidelity case. And so, quite frankly, there is a conflict in the law about what Wisconsin law is, because the fidelity case cites to Murray. And Murray, obviously, is a Supreme Court case.
Is fidelity a Seventh Circuit case?
It is, Your Honor.
But isn't it a case where we're not getting a certified question from the Seventh Circuit?
No, you are not.
What's going on is the Seventh Circuit is guessing as to what we might do given the facts. Isn't that right?
That's right. But to suggest that no one will ever now look at that case and suggest in Wisconsin that is the state of Wisconsin law and have someone else say, no, it's now Creefall 2, I think I think lawyers would try to rely on it. But I think what you have to do is not rely on direct action cases where people are trying to get fees on a direct case, because I would agree, those aren't recoverable under this rule. But that's not the case here, and it's clear, and fidelity cited to it, and Murray holds it, and no one has ever overruled Murray, and there's no reason nor policy to overrule it, because you are then rewarding wrongdoers and you are hurting innocent third parties. And that is not what the public policy of this great state has been, and nor should it be. And I see my time has ended.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. Any further questions? Ms. Carstensen?
If it pleases the court, I'm going to start because it's fresh in my mind right now, some of the things that Mr. Gordon said. First of all, the Weinhagen exception is not applicable here. As Justice Crooks pointed out, Wisconsin applies the American rule, where each party is responsible for its own fees, and they're not entitled to attorney's fees here because they were sued directly by the Creefalls as joint tortfeasors along with Excel and E&B. And in fact, their franchisee was also found liable. And I want to point out, because I've heard a lot of disparagement of my client, Excel, first of all, meat is labeled because it does have the potential to carry bacteria. So everyone, even when I'm cooking in my own home, I'm very careful not to cross-contaminate things. And the Creefall plaintiff, the two children in this case, they didn't even consume meat. They consumed watermelon and other things from the salad bar. I just have to get that off my chest because, and also the Court of Appeals found that our change in litigation strategy, they didn't label us a wrongdoer because at some point we changed our strategy in litigation. They found that it was appropriate to do that and they rejected a lot of these hyperbolic type arguments that are made here. So Sizzler was brought into the litigation not because we were a wrongdoer and we were evil. They were sued for their own direct allegations. And
if
that
you didn't
is the type
breach
of,
the warranty, would they have been sued?
You can say that in any.
I understand what you're saying, but if you're just talking about a breach warranty case, what would their damages be? They wouldn't have had to go through that had your warranty been.
If we had complied with our warranty. I would say the consequential damage limitation would limit them from getting this type of consequential damage. I can see that, but it's not a simple but-for causation. We could have breached our warranty had they cooked our meat properly, had their franchisee, which was one of the lowest ranked companies that they operate, not spread it to other foods, then they wouldn't have undergone all these.
Does it matter at all that they were found 0% negligent?
Not in this context, because they did defend direct allegations, and I think if you're going to open up that door, then you'll say in any case, for example, a medical malpractice case, where the attending doctor is sued, a resident is sued, a nurse is sued, if the resident is found liable and the other two are not, are they allowed to collect their damages from the co-defendant? No, that's never been the rule in Wisconsin.
I'm just thinking sometimes, you know, in bad faith cases or whatnot, you have the first step and you go through whether or not there's cover, or whether or not there's liability. And then if the person had to defend that whole time, then in a bad faith claim, they can go ahead and seek the damages that they incurred. And part of those damages are the fees that they incurred in that litigation. Do you follow what I'm saying?
I am following that, and that's the Duchamp case. I think it carves out a limited exception in Wisconsin for insurance bad faith cases. And I don't think that the Weinhagen they don't utilize, if I'm remembering correctly, they don't even reference Weinhagen in that case. This, in essence, I think that Sizzler is seeking to broadly open this door where it should not be opened when they sued direct they defended repeatedly, and of course, they don't mention, they really were in cahoots, we believe, with the plaintiff's attorney, and they pursued claims against us and vigorously, you know, prosecuted against us. But that doesn't change the fact that they were defending their own direct allegations of negligence. The same thing with the $1.5 million. There was a question about, was that an issue of fact on that payment? It was paid under an agreement labeled 8-8 under the statute for advance payments. But it really wasn't. It recited, this is not a settlement. You're not going to get this money back unless a judgment was entered against you. And the Creefall plaintiff's attorneys in front of Judge Kahn were like, we intend to collect all our damages from Excel, and we're not going to utilize this agreement. We're making an end run around Perringer. And Judge Kahn heard all these facts, and he made a conclusion based on the testimony of their own CEO that this was a voluntary payment and it was not recoverable. I see my time's up. 5 minutes goes fast. So,
thank you, Ms. Carstensen. Mr. Johnson.
Five minutes does go fast. I just want to cover briefly 2 points to make sure that in all our discussion we haven't lost track of it. First of all, on the on the whole issue of the Perringer releases, our position is that under the Eden Stone case, there is precedent in this state to say that we're entitled to contractual indemnification because, among other things, we settled contractual claims. And the fact that the parties utilize Perringer language in the release is beside the point. If you don't find Eden Stone to be controlling on that subject, then this is an issue on which there is no case in Wisconsin, because the Unigard case is not on point. It deals with different concepts, and it's in fact not even an indemnification case, no matter what someone threw into their pleadings. In that case, then, you're faced with the policy decision. In this case, where we clearly settled far more than our liability, and were forced to do it because they refused to live up to their contractual guarantees, refused to participate, are they to be allowed to escape from paying their fair share? After all, that was litigated. It's been determined their fair share is 80%, because they can try to argue that because the Perringer has language limiting the plaintiff's release to our negligence, it protects them from that. I think the answer from a public policy perspective, even if you say there's no authority on the subject, is clearly no, they should not be allowed to escape. The second question is, given the fact that we're talking about our being a damaged party, an injured party because of breach of contract.
Yeah, but you haven't proved any contract damages, Counselor. That's my problem with your argument.
Well, actually, we have proven substantial contract damages. They're just no longer at issue here.
Well, you're trying to collect what you say will compensate you for your damages by the money Federated paid, but you haven't proved that those are the same as the damages you claim you suffered.
I'm sorry, don't understand.
Contract damages require, a contract claim requires contract damages.
Yes.
Okay. You're attempting to get a payment that Federated made to settle out this claim, but I haven't heard anything or read anything in the record that says the dollar amount from Federated, $1 million, of which you want $800,000, is equivalent to the damages you sustained, $800,000, for breach of contract.
The contract says that they would defend, indemnify, and hold us harmless from all actions, suits, claims, and proceedings in a judgments, damages, fines, costs, and expenses arising from the breach of this agreement.
Yeah, but you haven't proved what those dollars are.
Yes, we proved them to the satisfaction of the trial court. The trial court made a finding that $3.5 million was paid. That's a factual finding which is not even attached.
That's not what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about you're trying to step in the shoes of Federated with your own contract damages. And I don't see the equation between what Federated paid and what you have proved as contract damages for E&B, just looking at the E&B part.
For two reasons.
Okay.
Number one, the Slug Seed case says that when they breach a contract and we are able to get payment from someone else for that, that doesn't reduce the damages they owe. It's not directly on point. It's the same concept. They're not. It's in effect establishing a collateral source rule for contract cases by saying they're not entitled to benefit from the fact that we had first-party property insurance that reimbursed us for some of the damages.
Yeah, well, that's where I thought this case started out for this claim, is that you're trying to put the collateral source rule onto a contract claim. I think that's what I said to you when you started. And you said to me, collateral source rule doesn't matter. They owe us damages simply based on the breach of the hold harmless agreement.
If you heard me to say that, I didn't mean to say it. It's almost the same thing. I said they're saying they don't have to pay because some of the damages were paid by a collateral source and they're able to take advantage of it. Our response is, under collateral source rule, that's not true because of the court's decision in the Fisher case. under the contract rules because their contract doesn't give them the right to do that, and because Slug Seed says the fact that we arrange to have other sources to compensate us for our losses caused by their breach doesn't benefit them. Whether you call that a collateral source rule or the contract rule from the Slug Seed case is perhaps the semantics I was accused of this morning.
Thank you.
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Gordon.
Just briefly, I want to respond to a statement by Xcel's counsel, somehow being in cahoots. Obviously, nothing in the record. And the paranoia that has been exhibited throughout this trial about what's been going on has been mind-boggling. Xcel's argument that somehow everyone else has been required to clean up their mess has been rejected in Creefall 1 by Judge Kahn in the circuit court, by the jury who absolutely exonerates Sizzler and barely tags EMB 20% with any liability. Now Creefall 2 reaffirms what the jury said, is that all of their arguments are a bunch of hooey. They still come to you and want to re-argue all of the facts that have been previously determined. That's what they want to do here to avoid their obligation to pay the attorney's fees as consequential damages, whether you call it an exception to the American rule or not. It is consistent with the Weinhagen rule that and the Murray case, which specifically outline the minimal requirements, and that is, are you an innocent third party? And if you're an innocent third party, you are entitled to full compensation, and a windfall should not benefit the wrongdoer.
Your opposing counsel talked about a hypothetical medical malpractice case with the resident. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would say that in any situation, because that's similar to the car accident, that situation that we've addressed previously down below. And I would say it's like this. Let's say you, Justice, are sitting, minding your own business at a stop sign, and you're behind a car, and someone comes and drives and hits you at 50 miles an hour and pushes your car, and you've done zero wrong, pushes your car into another car, who then sues both you, because anybody can plead anything. You can plead it. And that's why that the mere fact of an allegation of wrongdoing is irrelevant. But they could plead that you were negligent. Now, you say, well, what was I doing? And now, should you be forced to bear the burden of those those legal fees? Or should it be that person who rammed into you at 50 miles an hour? I say, because this is not going to expand litigation at all, that the public policy of making the innocent party whole far outweighs any benefit that the wrongdoer should be given. It's a windfall to them, and you shouldn't be put in that position, and it has zero impact on litigation. It might have some claims because people who will seek indemnity for those claims, but that's not going to cause a reduction in any litigation, and certainly you would have been in that lawsuit because of that third party only, and had you never been pushed into that other person, you never would have sued them just to get your attorney's fees. And that's the purpose of the American rule.
Okay. Well, let's apply the hypothetical situation that opposing counsel set. If I remember it correctly, there's some sort of medical malpractice.
Oh, sure, I have it. And one resident is not liable. And in that situation, Your Honor, if the victim, let's say the victim sues everybody, and some of the people have 0% responsibility, because it only arises if you are 0% responsible. And so they sue everyone, and it's found that the nurse or somebody has 0% responsibility, but they find that the hospital is negligent. Assuming no contractual relations between the nurses and the hospital, which might prohibit those claims, they could seek indemnity if they were the ones who were forced to pay the fees and the hospital wasn't defending them. Yes, they could.
That might be equitable, but it's my sense that it would turn our attorney fee jurisprudence in this state on its head. You know, I'm not saying it's not fair, but I'm saying that you take your hypothetical was the chain reaction. I say, welcome to Wisconsin in winter. There are lots of chain reaction automobile accidents. And maybe the car number three is, once it goes to trial, is going to be found 0% negligence. But the pleading is going to say too fast for conditions. And there is a cause of action that arguably can be maintained that if you were going slower for the conditions that you would have been able to stop or avoid. I mean, that's so, I mean, I can understand the equities, but it would sure change our law.
Well, Justice, I disagree with you. It wouldn't change Murray at all. It wouldn't change what Murray says are the requirements in order to invoke the rule. And while you may think that more people might ask for it, that's true, because I'm seeking a clarification on this. More people may ask for it, but it's not going to increase litigation. And so when you say the equities might be in favor of it, well, if the equities are in favor of it, and public policy, at least as Phillips states, is to make our victims whole, why should the wrongdoer benefit? And that's, if you don't give them to me, that's the impact of the rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. I want to thank all the counsel who appeared in their massive briefs and appendices in a very interesting case. This nine cases we've been hearing, really eight, this January, many have involved insurance. Many have involved not necessarily the insurance company paying to the injured party in the sense of an outside injured party, but involved relationships among various insurance companies covering various defendants in the lawsuit, and then the insurance companies and the various defendants being victims of each other, or not victims of each other, as they see fit. So court is and collateral estoppel has come up a number of times in these cases. So we're really quite deeply steeped in these issues. And we want to thank you for helping us. That closes the hearing on 09-AP-1213 and 10-AP-491, Estate of Brianna Creefall versus Sizzler. The court will, thus ends our scheduled oral arguments for January. The court will convene in closed conference at 3:20. Thank you.
Thank you.